Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It is I, Lantessa, and instead of saying hello, I should have been saying bonjour, bonsoir, and what else do they say in France? Arrivederci. No, different thing. Because today, we're going to be going all international on y'all, and I'm not talking about the International House of Pancakes. I'm talking about some international Disney theme park discussions, and here to talk with me about it, because he actually knows what we're talking about, is Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how are you?
Omelette du fromage, Len.
What is it? Omelette avec ham bone?
There we go. All right. That's all of French I've retained. It's very, very sad. So, you're right. In fact, what's so bizarre about what this moment in theme park history, it's fascinating. I mean, we have Diagon Alley's just done its media preview, and right on the back of that media preview, the Walt Disney Studios Paris, sort of lifted the veil on its Ratatouille attraction, which, I was talking with Roger Gould, who, you want to talk about the dream job? All right, this is a guy who, get started out as an animator. In fact, if you know the film Hercules, the Hydra sequence in that movie, this is the guy who did that. This is the guy who figured out how to create CG that fit in with hand-drawn and create a creature that, at one point, I think the Hydra has 30 separate heads. So, but that was what got him on Pixar's radar. They invite him up to Emeryville. He's been working there, and then just one day somebody comes to the office like, we're starting to do a lot of crap with Disney these days. Would you like to be the creative director of Pixar's theme park group? And that's his gig. This is the guy who goes down to the Disney parks and makes sure that, that everything's on model, and more to the point, he's a liaison between Imagineering and Disney. I mean, for example, on the very first project of size, the Finding Nemo submarine voyage. And they made 15 minutes of brand new animation for that thing. But again, to show you that he was the right guy for the job, and that, this is what I love about Roger. He was talking about the fact that, it wasn't the fact that, they were going to do their best, to put Nemo into this attraction. He said, we got to be careful here, guys, because we're competing. This is an attraction that Walt Disney himself put in the parks, and we're going head to head. It's not what people expect of what we do. It's their childhood memories. We actually have to be better than people's childhood memories. And so, just marching forward, he's been the guy who, interacts with Imagineering and gets these attractions up out of the ground. And though his good partner on this, Liz Grisano, she was the executive producer of it, the difference between doing a Pixar theme park attraction and a movie. I mean, for example, Liz was telling me about how in this particular attraction, the gimmick of it is that they do what a lot of films do. They do set extensions. So you have you are rat-sized for this attraction. I mean, seriously, when you enter the queue, you initially start off as human size, and then you're walking along a rooftop of Paris, and you have this beautiful view of the city, and then you come around a corner, and somehow you're now rat-sized, and you're in the same setting, but you have these little chimney pots that you've been looking at that are now towering over you. I mean, you're in a room that, again, picture this. This is just the load area, Len. It's the size of the battle scene from Anaheim's version of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Really?
I've got a 3.5 stories tall ceiling, and, to sort of sell the illusion that, you're the size that you are, there's this giant window next to the queue where through a curtain you can see this enormous human woman putting on lipstick. And it just sort of, everything sells that you're itty bitty. And, after they issue your 3D glasses, and after they, put you in your rat sized vehicle, which, by the way, trackless, just like Mystic Manor and Pooh's Honey Hunt in Tokyo, you're now sent off on this, this amazing attraction that, to back up the truck a little bit, this was actually Tom Fitzgerald, one of the, you know, veterans of Imagineering. In fact, he's the guy who just got put in charge of Epcot. He's going to be riding herd on the reimagining of that park for Florida. But he's the guy who came to them and said, let's explore the idea of doing, you know, I mean, we what we did in Cars Land is we explored in depth one world, one story. All the restaurants, I mean, you know, supported the idea, all the shops, you know, everything told you were in that one world. Let's do the same thing with Ratatouille. And so, and the funny part of this story is that when Pixar put out Ratatouille in 2007, they were kind of terrified about how the French would respond to it. Cause, you know, when you do animation, everything boils down to caricature. And it's like, and they were like, are they going to get it? Are they going to think we're being respectful and honoring Paris? Or are they going to think we're making, you know, or the French?
That's
or
right.
We're,
yeah.
We're making fun of them. And it turns out the French, you know, this movie, as well as it did in the States, it did huge numbers in Europe. They loved it. They thought, you know, oh, you know, it's just like Americans who understand the French. Finally, they get who we are. So it's like, okay. So, but then, you know, the whole notion of Tom, well, let's do a ride for the Walt Disney Studios Paris about Ratatouille. And it's just sort of like, to sit back for a moment and it's like, let me get this straight. We're going to build Paris 30 miles outside of Paris.
I, that's the thing. It's like, you know, let's build Los Angeles in Anaheim.
Yeah, you know, and if you remember Superstar Limo, how well that worked out, all right? And it's just sort of like, this is harder to do than it looks. And what they finally hit upon is like, look, this is not Paris. This is Remy's Paris. So, in fact, half the fun of when you go to this is that if you're, you know, forget about the hidden Mickeys. This is the land of the hidden Remy. I mean, for example, you know, there's a fountain in the middle of the Ratatouille Plaza. And normally in Paris, you know, you go up, it's a fountain, it's a lion's head spitting water. No, this is a rat, you know, and, you know, there are rats everywhere. There are rats on the tops of the manhole covers. There are rats hidden in the balustrades. It's all there. You know, but to sort of set the stage for this attraction. But all right. So anyway, you get on the ride, and like I was mentioning earlier, when they were working on development of this thing, they initially thought, can we do it physically? They spent a year trying to sort of work out, all right, if we did this with just physical props, giant physical props, you then end up in these weird spaces where it's like, if you're going to do a moment where, say, a giant human character is supposed to be almost stepping in your car, you got to craft this giant shoe. You then have to figure, well, in order for this to be effective, how fast does the shoe move? And what's the weight of the shoe? And what are the safety issues? And it just really broke down that they just couldn't get the giant props to move fast enough to make this energetic.
I hate it when physics gets in the way.
Yeah, that's it exactly. In fact, you know, the interesting thing is that this problem goes all the way back to when they were initially talking about doing the Wonders of Life Pavilion for Epcot. There was originally a ride where you physically were going to, you know, be in like an omnimover and move through the human body. And the thing that, you know, sort of broke the back of that take on the attraction was you were supposed to move through the human heart, and they had to, you know, how big does the heart have to be for an Omnibus to go through it, and how big does the valve have to open, and how fast? And it was just, you know, it was this engineering nightmare, and that was eventually what drove them into the arms of Body Wars. It's like, God, let's just do this as, you know, a simulator and, you know, to be done with it. But to give them credit that they loved so much of what they'd done with the physical props in the early development. In fact, Roger was telling me that it's actually within this, they've crafted the world's largest ham. And in fact, this ham is so large that when they were mocking it up, the safety people came through and said, no, it's, this is a roof, you know, because the vehicle was going to go under the ham. And so it's like, in order to install that ham in the attraction, the ham has to have sprinklers. So, You know, just the whole notion of, okay, you know, just send it back to the designer and tell them to put in some sprinklers. Because, of course, that's what you find in a really good ham. You know, never mind about the cloves, sprinklers. Sprinklers are what make a great ham. But yeah, I mean, it's just these giant props and what they just had. Well, look, in movies, they do this all the time. They shoot a movie and you know, the sets go up 20 feet and then there's green screen. So what we'll do this time around is we are going to do set extensions with film.
But the film.
So, you know, and in fact, what Roger was saying, and again, I don't know if this is a good part of the job or the bad part of the job, but he was talking about when they're doing show install and checking things and said, so how long did you end up riding the ride? And in fact, when we were talking, it was the week he was finally handing it over to ops. They had, it's done. I get to walk away and said, all right, how many times did I ride? It's got to be 500 to 600 times.
Really?
Yeah. But he was talking about, you know, he'd be on the ride and it's just sort of like one of these things where he was told, for example, you know, you gotta look at the ceiling and make sure that it looks like Linguini is actually lifting the curtain for the moment when, you know, Remy and his friends run up the wall. And he would just get so distracted because these giant props and the other gimmick.
There's a million things to look at, right?
I mean, there's a million things to look at. He'd come back and they're like, oh crap, I forgot to look at Linguini. Put me back on the ride. Damn it. But the other thing is with the and again, you as a software computer guy will appreciate this. They have finally figured out with this attraction. This is sort of the next step up from what Universal has done with Transformers and Spider-Man. They've discovered a geometry that allows them in basically 270 degrees of, you know, completely in focus animation projection. So for example, if you're looking dead ahead, you know, there's Remy who's out, you know, on the kitchen floor running ahead of you trying to guide you to safety. But if you look off to the left, you know, there's his brother Emil who's doing something goofy and getting himself in trouble. Or if you look directly overhead, here's, you know, a giant, you know, the giant human-sized Linguini who's running interference for you. Because, again, this is a kitchen full of, you know, chefs trying to get things done at the height of dinner time and, you know, sort of blocking your way and pushing people aside, trying to prevent people from stepping on
it. And the stuff around the edges isn't distorted or blurred even when it's being...
No, that's, in fact, the thing they're the proudest of. But here's the thing, okay? So they're projecting what they're going to be doing and what the animation needs for this and, you know, what they'll need to project this. And one of the, you know, the number crunchers of the city is like, Jesus, do you realize what we're talking about here? It's like with this much detail and, again, rendering everything in 3D, it's like, realistically, we're only doing 5 minutes of animation for this thing?
Yeah.
The files will be 4 times the size of the actual Ratatouille movie.
Oh, yeah, because it's so much larger in terms of scale.
So they go to finally that they're at the, the rap party, and the same, you know, the number cruncher comes up to Roger and Liz, and goes, I'm really sorry, I screwed up. He says, oh, what do you mean? He says, well, you know how I said it was going to be 4 times the size? It's like, yeah, it was 8. Yeah,
I mean, it's within an order of magnitude. It's good.
Yeah, you know,
so a movie is typically like 4 to 8 gigs, 64. Wow.
Yeah, so think about that, and just, you know, and getting that footage done. But again, the best part of this thing, you have to understand that everybody who works at Pixar are theme park geeks, and Brad Bird was so excited that they were doing this. Again, this is Brad. Live action, Mission Impossible, you know, now working on Tomorrowland, you know, the George Clooney movie, actually would come up to Pixar and review the animation and give story notes. I mean, he was just so thrilled they were doing this with his characters.
That's great.
But the other thing that's really, you know, you of all people will appreciate. Okay, so again, not to spoil the storyline of this thing, but basically, you know, the idea, the show starts off with Remy is sort of stressing about guests are, you know, you are his guest, our guest coming for the night. And it's like, what should I make for these folks? And it's like, and the ghost of Auguste Gusteau is sort of floating around him and suggesting, you know, coq au vin or simple omelette. And it's like, oh, what about ratatouille? And it's like, oh, that's a great idea. But you're on the skylight of the restaurant, you know, discussing this. And when he jumps at you, he's like, it's a great idea. the skylight opens and he falls to the floor and you go with him and now you're trapped in the kitchen and, you know, almost being crushed and you go hide under the stove and they turn on the stove and there's a heat effect and you have to scurry before your, you know, your hair gets fried. And meanwhile, Emil and his friends are running loose in the kitchen as well. Anyway, long story short, you escape the kitchen, you go into the formal dining room of the Auguste Gusteau, and mm-hmm. Skinner is chasing after you, and you eventually, like in the movie, you end up on the wall of the building, and you're scurrying up top, but Skinner is chasing you and reaching in at you, and finally you make it to the kitchen, the restaurant that Remy opened at the end of the film, where right. he's, you know, and you actually get to go in the kitchen and see all of his restaurant his rat friends helping him prepare this meal. And it's like, for what they describe, it's like Cirque du Soleil. You are in the middle and, you know, mushrooms are flying over your head and, you know, rats are flipping, you know, fish from one pan to the other. And you come around to your finale and here's everybody in the restaurant, you know, the rat-sized restaurant that you saw at the end of the film. And they welcome you and, you know, they wave you on. And you come around the load area, and for the first time in the history of a Disney theme park, you don't exit through a gift shop. You exit through a restaurant.
It's beautiful.
But it's not just a restaurant. It's the same rat-sized restaurant that you had in the movie. So, you know, for example, all the chairs in the restaurant are corks.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures online. It's hysterical. They're champagne corks.
Yep. And, you know, for example, every table, because it's Paris and they get a lot of winter there, has a coat rack, but the coat rack is a giant fork, yep. You know, and, you know, the decorations of the room are, you know, giant champagne bottles and plates and, but it's all,
you say giant though, I mean, the plates are 8-9 feet tall.
That's it. Exactly.
The cookbook, there's a cookbook decorating it. It's 12 feet tall. The things on top of your tables are, you know, those little paper umbrellas you get with drinks, but just, yep. You know, made giant to like, you know, 5 feet wide.
Yeah, but it's just, I mean, the tabletops are jelly jar tops or ramekins, the yep. CD. I mean, they just totally committed to this. It's their version of Cars Land, and they are just so proud of this thing. But now we come to the tough part. You know, obvious question of like, wow, it sounds tremendous. When is this traveling? And it's not.
By traveling, you mean?
Clone. When is it, and in fact, there's been a lot of discussion in the fan community about, ooh, there's this Remy thing, and wouldn't it be a nice fit for Paris at Epcot?
Yeah, which doesn't actually have a ride.
Which doesn't actually have a ride. But it does have an expansion pad right next or right behind it. In fact, interestingly, when you take the perimeter road, for World Showcase, that expansion pad is actually where all of the houses for Food and Wine are kept. That's where they're held during their off season. So it's a giant, you know, they actually could actually fit this thing. But the hard reality is that this is a different Disney company than when Michael Eisner was running it. And much like Mystic Manor is a point of pride for Hong Kong Disneyland right now. I mean, everyone looks at it right and like, wow, I want that to come to my park. And it's like, well, you can want it, yeah. But it's going to be an exclusive here for at least 4 or 5 years. And then maybe it'll, you know, be cloned and go around the world. And that's actually the same thing with Remy and Ratatouille. It's an amazing attraction, but we're in 2014 right now. And realistically, if they've got a 5-year exclusive, the earliest this could travel to the States, you know, this spectacular attraction is 2019, 2020. So.
Wow.
And that's tough to hear, particularly with the understanding that Tom Fitzgerald, you know, the guy who wrote Hurt on this and knows how amazing it is now going to be the guy in charge of Epcot. But, this is, again, the notion of if Disney is truly an international, you know, an international entertainment company and wants each of its theme parks and resorts to have bragging rights and a reason for people to fly there and experience things, yeah. They do have to have exclusives. And that's what this is. So, but again, kudos all around. It doesn't officially open to the public till July of July 10th. Yeah. But they are doing all sorts of openings, all sorts of annual pass holder, exclusives, that sort of thing. So again, if you're headed to Paris, be sure to check this out and bring me back some ratatouille, please.
Fantastic. It looks really good, actually. The restaurant looks fantastic, and you know it's always good to have another restaurant in the especially in that park.
Ironically enough, evidently this is their first really for real sit down restaurant. That you know, there's a lot of quick service, there's a lot of buffeteria type stuff, but you know, no real hand me the menu, let me see what I want, go make it, you know, which I get really surprised me, you know, to hear that. But, you know, they're very pleased with the way it turned out. I guess the one thing that Roger was saying is that, again, they've just, you know, they've handed off to ops and they're looking at their pretty restaurant. And it's like, wow, is anybody going to want to leave here?
In Paris, where you could sit for 2 hours, right?
I mean, yeah. So they've actually supposedly been conferring with the folks at Be Our Guest about, well, how do you get them to leave? You know, it's like,
we pulling the fire alarm sprinklers here.
That's right. You know, somebody put a light a match under the ham, please. All right, let's get those sprinklers going. So
that's incredible. Wow, it looks really good.
Yep.
So the other thing you've been doing, you've been a busy man this last month. You attended the Diagon Alley press event.
Yeah, and wow, I mean, the irony of, you know, talking with Roger about the Ratatouille land, and he made a point of talking about, you know, he's been working with Imagineering since 2007 or about, and he said the group has never been more fired up, more passionate. They feel great about the stuff that's in the pipelines, and they can't wait to get this stuff out. And that's the exact same thing with the Universal Creative. They work so hard to get Diagon Alley out the door, and to just, you know, when we were at the press event, you'd come to the door and you'd see the guys who worked on it, and they just wanted to see the faces of people coming through the wall at Diagon at the Leaky Cauldron. In fact, I had to turn around and stand with them for a while to see what they were looking at. And it's like, and it was amazing. You'd see people come through, and you know how we all are today. You got your cell phone out and you're documenting what you're doing. And people would hold the cell phone up for about 10, 15 seconds, and then they'd drop it and they'd be taking it all in, and the cell phone would like shrink down to like belly level, and their jaws would drop, and they're like, oh crap, I'm supposed to be taking pictures. Don't come back up. I've never seen something defeat the cell phone before, and this did it. It's just, it's hard to describe. Honestly, you cannot see the rest of the park. When you come through that wall, and you know, you've got Diagon Alley rising up around you, 4 and 5 stories tall. And, you know, every 10 or 15 minutes, the dragon on top of Gringotts suddenly sends his gout of flames out. And the wizards that are walking around the street and the animated windows. And it's like, this is everything they did in Hogsmeade, only moved to the next level. I mean, it's what's fascinating is this was my third time into Diagon Alley. I was lucky enough in January to get a walkthrough while it was still a construction site. And then a couple of months back, I got to take part in the tastings at Leaky Cauldron. But to see it fully propped, painted, moving, was just stunning. And you know, the other things, you know, I know early on I expressed some concerns about crowding conditions and size and that sort of thing. It turns out if once you can get actually up Diagon Alley and get to the top of the street in front of Gringotts, the horizontally, thank you, is much larger than you might expect. More to the point, there's sort of a back entrance into Nocturne Alley, so the flow through is so much better. And Carket Market is huge.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just and more. The best part of it is it's got a giant glass ceiling, which A, holds in the air conditioning, which is a good thing in Central Florida, and more to the point, keeps the rain out. So you can hang in this place when it really gets, you know, again, challenging weather-wise. And it was actually, they kept taking us in and out through the back, and finally they rolled us by the back of Gringotts, and the exterior queue for Gringotts out behind the actual show building, mm-hmm. they have space back there for 4,000 people.
That's what I heard, yeah, two and a half hours worth of the queue.
Yeah. And it's just sort of like, so I think this is going to eat a lot of people, but at the same time, I'll be honest with you, Len. Even Universal is a little concerned about how long people are going to linger in here. Because
you mean they're not going to leave?
Yeah,
it's like once you've made it over the wall from East Germany to West Germany, here, hey, we need you to leave. Nine.
Yeah, no, that's it exactly. I mean, between the entertainment options, I mean, you know, the two shows that Mike Aiello wrote. You know, the interaction with the AA figure. In the sort of the cash exchange, you can make elixirs. And at the same time, to watch how smart they were about the lessons that they learned previously. I mean, for example, if you do Ollivanders, anyone who's done Ollivanders previously to Hogsmeade knows what a misery it was to stand out. Side there.
I was unshaded. Oh my god.
Yeah, and just, well, you know.
Thankfully, the one merciful thing they did to people is they won't let you get in line there if it's more than an hour.
Yeah.
Because apparently that's as long as it takes to cook a chicken in that heat.
Oh, yeah.
And I got the worst sunburn there. Because, you know, you go back, you're actually back behind that little building. And there's no shade. Anyway, so what?
And more to the point, you're surrounded by black stone and black buildings.
And stone, yeah.
And so it's holding the heat. So it's not just the sunburn, Len. I mean, that's deep tissue cooking there, all right? I mean, never mind about sunscreen. Just slather yourself with a barbecue sauce.
Right. And they've done that, actually. The time that I was there, they were bringing people out with misters to mist the crowd.
Yeah,
and I'm like, you know, this is just some sort of moisturizer to make us tender.
Now, conversely, what they've done with Ollivanders over in Diagon Alley. First of all, instead of one room doing, there were three. You won't know it going through the queue, but the walls full of books and wands, you know, those are three separate doorways made to look like faux walls. And more to the point, the queue is all inside. It's all air conditioned.
Really?
Yep.
And how many people can the queue inside hold?
I want to say easy, 150 to 200 people.
And you're getting how many people per show?
You're getting it's typically 27 per show.
Yes, yeah, 30. Yes, okay.
So you and again, when you're running three different wizards at the same time, there's zero weight. They dump you right into the same, you know, a larger wand shop that's easier to move around. That said, though, I did not, and in fact, they were just at this press event. I mean, a couple days beforehand, they had announced the interactive wands, which, by the way, Len had given me the heads up about 2 weeks, or actually 2 months early. And I was kind of flabbergasted because, like, no, they wouldn't dare bring those online just as they're opening in Diagon Alley. And sure enough, they did. And there are 18 different places within Diagon Alley where you can use these wands. The interactive ones.
And they're, $45, right? $44.95.
$45, which is, again, one and a half times what you pay for the beautiful movie, replica wands.
So 50% more, but they're interactive.
But at the same time, 18 places you can use them in Diagon Alley, 9 places over at Hogsmeade.
27 places.
27 places. But I will tell you, much like everything at Diagon Alley. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a lot of it worked right out of the box. It was interesting, though, to watch virtually every place that had a wand thing. They had a cast member positioned to walk you through how to do the moves because, much to their chagrin, when they gave a wand to Al Roker on the Today Show to use live as part of their introduction, took Al about 3 times, and
that's not bad, though, 3 times.
On live television.
It's a bad planning there, but
And
I understand that so there's little markers where you're supposed to stand, right? And the markers in the marker is embedded or engraved the motion that you're supposed to do to activate the window, right?
That's it exactly.
So that's not bad.
Yeah, but again, I forget who was saying about, I really want to bring my Sorcerer of the Magic Kingdom cards over and see what happens when I use them.
Don't cross the streams, man.
There you go. That's right. If we've learned nothing from Ghostbusters, don't do that, kids. All right, but
so
you know,
so you've seen the you saw Nocturne Alley.
Yep.
You went in the. Did you go in all the shops? You went in the Magical Menagerie.
Magical Menagerie actually has one of the cooler. You know, again, they specialize in things that are off to the side that, you know, maybe the average guest wouldn't notice. But seriously, with Magical Menagerie, you want to actually go to sort of a little back alley place. In fact, right across the way is Diagon Alley's main restaurant, comfort station. You know, and in fact, you'll know you're going in the right side because there's one side with the wall decorated with a male wizard and the other side decorated with a female wizard. But in this window that's in the alley facing that way, that the 90% of the people are ignoring, there is the world's largest animatronic python. You know, and it's just sort of coiling and, you know, constantly moving. But if you know you're Harry Potter, you know from, you know, that Harry spoke Parseltongue. He could speak to snakes. And so if you stand there for about 30 seconds or so, the snake sort of eyeballs you and begins to talk. But it's just sort of, it's sort of this very hissy voice that you can almost make out. So the insinuation is, well, you must be a wizard. You're kind of understanding what the snake is saying.
That's nice.
Just in a window off to the side. But at the same time, that shop's worth going into anyway because they've got this wonderful fat animatronic cat up on, up one of the top shelves. And if you actually watch the rat cage that sort of hangs as a chandelier in it, it's draped with a cloth. So the rats are supposedly sleeping, but you can see them doing gymnastics or tumbling and clearly trying to figure out how to get out of the cage. By the way, it's always interesting the information you get from the people who run the shops, but evidently the breakout sale for plush, when people are buying supposedly their pet to take to school, and they've got phoenixes in there, they've got rats, they've got everything from the, you know, you can get, your own snowy white owl, you know, just... Hedwig, just like Harry did, but the one that's selling out the door is the mangiest looking cat. You know, it's Hermione's cat, but just barely cat-like, just this mangy, horrible looking things. But that really? Is the thing that people go, oh, I want one, and they go. So,
really? The ugly cat?
The ugly cat.
Huh.
The only thing I want to caution people about is that during the media preview, they were having some very significant issues with the Gringotts coaster, and I don't necessarily want to get into why they were having issues with it. They were stressing that, look, this is a preview, and you know that's what you do at previews. You try things, and sometimes everything doesn't work. They're doing their damnedest to make sure that, this amazing coaster type vehicle works, come the 8th when this thing opens to the public. On the other hand, the Hogwarts Express right out of the box, complete charmer, operated flawlessly. Though, there was one moment, and again, I'm not going to reveal this guy's name. Because everybody had been told that, you know, what's great is if you go in the King's Cross station and you ask, you know, is this the way to platform 9 3/4? The Universal team members have been expertly trained. It's like, I'm sorry, sir, we have platform 9 and we have platform 10. We don't have a platform 9 3/4. You know, and so you're just supposed to push on and trust that you're going to get there. And it turns out that when the queue is full, there's actually this point, a turn in the track that they've achieved the Pepper's Ghost effect where you can actually see the people ahead of you seem to walk into a wall and disappear.
Oh.
So, but again, the only problem with this is full queue. If the queue isn't full and you can stop and see this effect, you can walk through it without seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I am not revealing the name of the webmaster, but there is a point in the actual queue where there's clearly assigned to platform 9 and assigned to platform 10, and he evidently took what we'd heard very, very seriously and ran at full speed at the wall, figuring that this was where the effect was. And I mean,
the wall didn't move, did it?
Wall didn't move. Poor guy was sporting a pretty impressive egg the next day, but on his forehead. But so again, don't. You know, again, learn from others' mistakes. Just move through the queue and keep your eyes open, and you'll see the Pepper's Ghost, and then you'll get loaded on this absolutely charming train ride. If you come from the King Cross Station side, the Hogwarts Express actually backs into the station, so you're not really getting the beauty shot, so to speak. But you know, you step onto the train. There are three train cars. Each of the train cars has six compartments. Each of these compartments holds eight people. And when you take your seat on, you know, and again, it's not plastic. It's an upholstered bench and looks very much like an English train car. And when it starts to go out of the station, you have, you have the door of the compartment is closed, and sort of a frosted glass, so you can see people walking back and forth. And the nice thing is that they have this whole loop of, you know, Harry, Ron, and Hermione walking by and, you know, looking for an open car, and a, you know, woman walking by, you know, with a trolley full of, you know, Hogwarts specific treats. So, you know, there's this moment where all the chocolate frogs get loose, and you know, when you're going to King's Cross, from King's Cross to Hogsmeade Village, you're actually, at one point, there's a Dementor on the train, and you know, this is a great moment when the Dementor's hand actually touches the frosted glass, and you get the ice effect that, you know, you get from Dementors. But this, you know, at the same time, if you're just looking at the window, you know, between, you know, it takes you from, you know, the heart of London, where, you know, everything looks normal, except that every so often you see an owl flying through carrying a letter, or in the distance you see Death Eaters soaring through the sky, and you travel through the countryside and pass Malfoy Manor, and you really want to pay attention during the Malfoy Manor stuff, because there these weird random lightning strikes that happen around the house. And if you keep an eye out, there's a dead tree, and during one lightning strike, you'll see Voldemort. That's one of their Easter eggs. He's basically standing in the shadows of the tree.
Oh, cool.
But again, you go through the Forbidden Forest and you see, you know, the Fort Anglia. In fact, ironically enough, this is the flying car that Ron and Harry used in, you know, the Chamber of Secrets. And originally was supposed to be the ride vehicle for Forbidden Journey until they figured out it would take forever to load and unload people. So it's nice to see them. You have this back, and you come around Black Lake, and there's the castle. And when you pull into the station, who's there to greet you? But just as he does with all the first years, there's Hagrid. And the nice thing is, going the opposite direction, entirely different ride film, entirely different experience. You know, you get to see centaurs running through the Forbidden Forest. The older Weasley brothers fly by and are throwing fireworks at the train. And, you know, and in fact, as you pull into London, you get to see the night bus weaving its way through the streets. And instead of Hagrid at the station, you see who's waiting for you there, but Mad-Eye Moody. I mean, it's for a Potter fan, this is a dream that they, you know, between the detailing and, you know, just the, you know, now mind you, there've been, of course, we're theme park fans, so we'll bitch and moan about anything. And there've been some quibbles because, you know, people who were listening to Ron and, Hermione and Harry wandering the corridor, it's like, Hermione doesn't sound like herself. And well, there's a reason for that. Emma Watson, evidently at the last minute, opted not to be part of this. Or
really? Why?
You know, you're old enough to remember this, Ron. Remember how, you know, Leonard Nimoy wrote a book, I Am Not Spock?
Yeah.
You know, the whole, I'm not going to be, you know, in this box where I can only be one. And it was evidently the same thing with, I am blanking his name, the gentleman who plays Harry, Daniel Radcliffe. Same thing. Evidently he didn't come back either. And you know, it's just young actors who played the same roles in 8 movies and, you know, wanting to spread their wings and
do something else.
Yeah, look, we'll get him back in 10 years. I mean, remember that, you know, 20 years after Leonard Nimoy wrote I Am Not Spock, he wrote I Am Spock.
Yeah.
You know? So they all eventually come around. But it just for now, you know, just it, I think the first time around, in fact, that the people in Universal Publicity were telling me about the very first time. You know, they had actually flown the actors over for the opening of the original Hogsmeade. And so, you know, it's like, look, we're in this giant room where only the first two rows are filled with the actors and they're explaining what they're doing. And the presentation breaks up and the way that Tom Schroeder explained the story to me, he said, you know, Daniel Radcliffe came across the room like a gazelle, you know, just bounding toward the stage and just grabbed his hand and like, I am just so excited to be here and this looks so cool. And I just, oh my God, it's just like, thank you for doing this. And he's like, wow, okay. You know, just I'm used to aloof American actors who are self-important and these British kids were so great. And I think the difference here is that just in the past 4 or 5 years, this went from being something really cool to, wow, this is a huge business. Because, you know, let's remember, we've got Harry Potter Diagon Alley opening on, you know, July 8th. And then 1 week later in Osaka at Universal Studios Japan, their version of The Wizarding World opens up. And then 2 years after this in Hollywood, you've got the supersized version on the upper lot at Universal Studios Hollywood. So this suddenly went from a fun one knockoff thing to it's an industry. And yeah. I think that kind of took some of the fun of it out of it for, you know, some of the name actors. But again, give them a couple of years. They'll come back, you know, and more to the point, just as, you know, January of this year, you know, Universal had their first, you know, Harry Potter celebration, which to hear them talk is going to be their Star Wars weekend. You know, give them a couple of years, and, you know, this will become an annual thing that will slot somewhere between Mardi Gras and Halloween Horror Nights. So
awesome.
So, but no, definitely worth checking out. But I guess the thing that makes me happiest, Len, is honestly between what's happening, you know, just happened in Paris, you know, the opening of, you know, Ratatouille Land and Diagon Alley and, you know, just jumping back to the Seven Dwarfs Mine Train with those amazing projected faces and that tremendous, you know, you finally got the chance to ride that, right?
Actually, it wasn't bad. It's way better at night.
Yeah, no, that's it exactly. In fact, you know, I think wanted to stress that early on that, you know, particularly for the mine scene and as well to get to see that final show scene, you got to see these things at night. And that coupled with, you know, what they're doing at Knott's right now, where they're, you know, ripping out classic attractions or taking classic attractions like Calico Mine Train or the Timber Mountain Flume and just shutting them down and putting in, you know, brand new AA figures and really theming them up. And it's just this amazing time to be a theme park fan. And in fact, it's Terry Koo, who's the creator for Universal, who really put it in terms that makes it exciting. It's like, look, we're living in an age now where, yeah, you can sit at home and watch a movie, you know, on your flat screen, or you can go to a movie theater and you can see something in IMAX that's 10 stories tall and it's in 3D and it's so immersive. And it's like, that's the age we're in right now for theme parks. You know, we are in the time where it's like, we're 10 stories tall IMAX and digitally projected in 3D. You know, you're not getting in a ride vehicle and doing Snow White Scary Adventure. You are in the story. You know, we are putting you in, you know, just in the world of one story, but you're just, you know, you're as deep as you want to go. And, you know, as the people at Universal are a little concerned about, it's like, how long are they going to stay? You know, particularly if you're somebody who's standing outside trying to get into the Diagon Alley and you've been in line for 2 hours or so and it's not moving, it's like, what's going on? Things broken down? It's like, no, everything's working fine. They just don't want to leave. So,
that's awesome.
So just be aware that that could happen this summer. So
It's the victim of their own success thing.
There you go.
Excellent. So. Well, Jim, thanks very much for the update. It seems like we have to head out to Universal Orlando, and we've got to go over to Paris.
Oh, and speaking of things that we're going out for, I guess we should mention the thing in August.
Oh, that's right. We're doing an event.
God help us, folks. again, you know, that I don't know how this happened, but yes, Len and I
what
are
do you
going
mean
to do
work release. I know exactly how this happened. Then you talk to your parole officer?
That's right. They let me off the leash. And Len and I and Mike Newell are doing an event this summer. In fact, we're going to Flushing, which, given the quality of the show, is a very appropriate term. With Flushing Meadows, we're doing a show in honor of the 50th anniversary of the World's Fair. What is it? The World's Fair Marina Restaurant or something to that effect. It's going to be just what you hear now, only we're going to have people there. And I understand that, Len, you've already set up the rotten lettuce and tomato concession, right?
So exactly. We'll be selling stuff you can throw at us.
That's right. So this is audience participation, folks. And you can bring your own rotten fruit if you want. But yeah, it's going to be us talking. I think there's going to be food. Mr. Newell does party tricks. Is that my understanding?
He's a magician on the side. Did you know that?
I did not know that. Wow. But,
and we'll be doing a Captain and Tennille karaoke event as well. So go to etccustomevents.com. Take a look for our event.
Yep.
Tickets are $80?
$75? I have
somewhere
no
there.
Idea.
Includes lunch and three talking heads for a couple hours.
People in New York,
you know, they got tons of money. It's totally worthwhile. But we'll be talking about the World's Fair. We'll be doing a live show like this and recording it. If you guys have trip planning questions, other questions about Disney or other theme parks, we'll be happy to answer them. If not, we can make up something that sounds really, really good.
That's my entire career path.
Entire afternoon. It'll be a lot of fun.
All right. Well, so until then, I guess we'll look for something else to talk about. So.
Great. Thanks for being on the show, Jim. For the rest of you guys, please go on to iTunes, rate our show, tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide to Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. We'll see you on the next show.
Take care.